So you don't have an objection in principle to making a sequel. It's just that
not really. It's just we've always got attracted by something else. I mean, that's the classic example, because you've never done a wildlife, it might be something quite interesting to try.
Yeah, that's true, very
much the way we operate. You know, if there's, you know, enough people tell you the Industrial Revolution is the most boring subject in the world, you think, oh, right, well, let's see what we can do with this, then.
Yeah.
It's a kind of, see if you can do something different.
It's like the oldest tree in the world, you know.
Yeah.
Try and make a film about a dead, non-moving, ugly object.
Yeah.
And,
But, I mean, these things are often interesting because people don't take them on. I mean, if you said, go and make a film about, ghosts. Now, we know tomorrow, if we went to Discovery Channel and said, we got the perfect series for you, it's about haunted houses in England. Oh, you know, how much money do you want? Honestly, it would be like that. So there are areas where you get producers crawling all over it because there is, and then there are other areas, the Industrial Revolution's one, oldest tree in the world's another one, where they're actually quite difficult things to sell as films. Mm. In fact, we didn't have to sell them because it came to us with the idea in both cases. But. Mm. And then that makes it more interesting, because then you think, well, nobody's been at it before. Mm. You know, it's a story that nobody's really been, nobody's done. Mm. So it's fresh, you know.
It's a shame all of us here, because you see, you may think that I'm obsessive, I'm an obsessional sort of person, but Oliver is something else, and Oliver is a complete, you know, Once he's onto something, he will just keep going all the time. I mean, he just never lets go. I mean, he's quite extraordinary. And that's the main thing I learned from him on the film that I did in Los Angeles with him about this man who did the first genetic engineering experiment. When we locked ourselves up in this hotel, the Chateau Marmont, for about, I don't know, it must have been about a month. Oliver was like the most high-powered barrister, and that's what he was like. I mean, he assembled all the information, he had reams and reams of material, and just absolutely was determined that by the time this, we'd finally got permission to interview him, and he was the goal, he would have every question and every riposte, every answer, all worked out. And the interview that he did with him was absolutely just devastating. I mean, it formed the backbone of the film.
Mm.
And that's someone that is totally driven in anything that he's done. I mean,
well, that's the thing about our company, you see. They're three completely different people. You probably know this. I mean, we're completely different people, you know.
How would you describe their characteristics?
Their characteristics?
No, your
characteristics. Oh, my characteristics.
The three entirely different people's characteristics.
Oh, the three. Oh, I see. Oh, gosh.
We've heard of one obsessive.
Yours was
Carlo,
this actually, isn't it?
Carlo, how would you describe
it? Can't ask us.
He's sinking under the table with the responsibility.
That's Carlo and Julian Paul.
Yeah. Okay, how would you describe these three?
You've got a contract coming up.
Just remember that.
In what way? Do you want to?
Well, they've obviously got different talents. Let's start with the talents.
Before we get to the
just talents.
Well, I don't know. Well, I was always struck from kind of day one in the different ways and the different films they do. Like in very blunt terms, Paul does the very very arty stuff.
Mm, yeah.
And kind of Dave does a lot of the kind of in between you and Oliver, really, don't you?
I don't know.
No, I think.
Oh,
no, it's maybe wrong.
David's in the middle,
and Oliver does the real, really deep and kind of human interest stuff that maybe is, you know, hard to do from that point of view, I think. I kind of David's in the middle of them all.
Mm.
But what I really found, what is really good about them, the fact that they are all different, which I don't think from anyone I know who's worked in other companies, is when, you know, there's a problem to be solved or something. If someone's, one of the films isn't working, you know, they'd all get together and get in the cutting room and try and sort it out.
Mm.
And that is a way in which I think, you know, having three different people who are very different can see new ways of doing things or throw new light on something and turn the film round into a different direction. And I've noticed that from many instances, you know, that someone's got a problem with the film because you've been working on it for so long and you're not quite sure what it is because you've been working on it for years, and then they'll get the other two in and they battle it out and they, you know, the producer a better product because of that. And that's what's interesting for having three very, very different people working in that kind of way, I think.
Hmm.
I don't quite know how to describe it. It's hard to describe and put a finger on exactly what... You know when you see them all together how they're very different. But it's hard to describe them in unique ways than themselves.
How would you do it, Paul? Have you edited for all of them?
Oh, God, yes!
Paul on the spot.
Yeah, Paul's the one who sees all the crap.
This is the man who knows the truth.
Yeah, he has to wade through it.
No, I mean, Windfall Films is the A-team, definitely. That's pinching David's expression, but it's true. I think David was absolutely right. If in another life, Oliver would be... He would be a barrister, he'd be working in the legal profession.
Yeah.
He's got that kind of mind, and Oliver likes to get underneath things.
Yeah.
And he's got a fantastic nose for dishonesty and disingenuousness, and it's well, actually Oliver taught me something, and it's kind of obvious once you know it, but it was a fantastic object lesson. It was when we were working on The Decision, and we had a lot of material, hours and hours of rushes, and we put the first assembly together of the PVS film, the vegetative state film, and it's a very sad story about a young guy on a life support machine, and his parents were having to make the decision whether to take him off the life support. He'd been in this coma basically for a couple of years, and we'd put together a first cut which I thought was very clear and kind of told the story. And Oliver wasn't impressed at all, and what we'd relied on was a lot of, as you often do when you're trying to tell a story, is a lot of second-hand interview material, which where people are very rational and they're saying, well, this happened and that happened, and they're kind of telling the story at second-hand. And Oliver said, you've got to get the first-hand material. I want to see things as they're happening. Because there's absolutely no substitute for you when you're seeing something unfurling in front of your eyes. There's no substitute for that, and that is Oliver's forte. Is actually that kind of filmmaking where it's not the kind of putting it together after the event. It's actually being there at the event. So that is Oliver's great strength. Ian is, it's a bit unfair because I know Ian's background, so, but
he went to film school.
Yeah, we went to film school.
Oh, I see, so there was some reference to his prison sentence.
But Ian knows about polishing the individual frame of film, you know, most of us work with fairly rough-hewn material, and you know, as an editor, you know, I just kind of put blocks of things together. But Ian polishes with a fine chisel, and understands all those skills, which probably have something to do with being a painter and understanding light and working with materials. And it's very interesting because, I mean, I came into the business from having been at art school and not done anything really sensible all that time at art school. But it's kind of interesting what you bring with you. And you think, television's a very strange kind of business because it's a very imprecise kind of science. And and in a way, you can kind of make it up as you go along. But when I first came to the business, I never really understood how having an interesting painting or art could possibly be of any use in the business. But actually, as you get more into it, it's very instructive, and bringing that knowledge with you helps enormously. You know, just having a sense of compositional colour, all those kind of things. And I think to some extent, everyone working in the business has those kind of skills. But I don't know. I mean, you'd probably still be out there painting if you hadn't kind of collided with film or television.
Yeah,
or something.
I'm sure would.
And
definitely. And also the other thing is that, you know, that, I mean, in terms of this, the day the world took off, I mean, a lot of the way it looks and the whole, you know, feel of it owes to Ian's first program, because that vision of the rocket, which is, you know, not real. I mean, it's not real at all, but it is entirely Ian's thing, and that's what gives it the visual stamp, which I think is very important, and why it's partly why it's captured people's imagination, I think. It's really,
what's sort of weird though about that thing is it's sad how quickly that becomes a cliche, you know.
Yeah.
That the ways you find to do these things sort of become part of, I'm not saying I was first at it either, but there are ways of treating how you make a reconstruction, you film something, and everybody's at it.
Mm.
And so what was fresh when you first did it suddenly becomes the way to do it, you know, the way everybody, the technique everybody uses. So.
But it's often not done as well.
I'm always thinking, well, it's not. That's never the important thing for me. Mm-hmm. The thing I've always striven for. I mean, working with David. I mean, David and I once directed a film together, didn't we? We did that banknote film together.
Oh, yeah.
And I would always go out prepared for my shoot, with like almost like a storyboard, you know, everything's written. And David used to go out with like literally the back of an envelope. I mean, I'm kidding you not. I think he used to say envelopes up. And he'd written down like three sentences on the back, and that's all he had on the day's filming. And somehow, you know, I always thought, Christ, I wish I, you know, that's what I always wanted to do, because then you're open to what happens during the day. You know, you're open to the things that change when you're out there doing it. And I've always been very kind of, you know, anal about this sort of plan thing. And David's been the complete opposite. I'm unbelievable. Yeah. Is that it? You know, what are we going to do all day? We're going to be done but in 2 hours. But then, of course, as you're there, things you find that things are happening all the time. And David's always had an eye for it, you know. I remember you telling me about sitting outside Maxwell's room for a day or something, just waiting for something to happen with a crew. And I wouldn't be able to. Fine, I'll have to go out.
Heard of the Three Musketeers.
The Three Musketeers, yeah.
How would you describe?
It's the one that gives him most trouble in the castle.
No, that is not true. That's not true at all.
Damn, it must be.
No,
it's the hardest one.
It is in a way. David. Fantastic analytical mind. I know a bit about David's background, so I know he's got this fantastic scientific mind.
This is your life.
This is your life. But the eye-opener for me, for David, was cutting a program called Kaboom, which was the history of explosives. And it was working on that program I realised David is actually an anarchist, and potentially, you know, we're talking about other lives and other times, and if we weren't all safely employed in this in this industry, I think David would have been out there blowing things up.
Well, notice that in the gunpowder part of the series, that was the one that had the greatest
possibly death. Possibly for Her Majesty's government or for some other agency. There's definitely this love of chaos and anarchy, and which is completely contradictory, because to make programs you've got to be incredibly organised. But it's great fun in the cutting room because, as Ian was saying, it's that thing of not having everything mapped out. And working on this series, The Day the World Took Off, if anyone could have come up with a set of ideas that would A, be quite difficult to make in the first place, and then B, making it slightly more difficult, and then C, making it almost impossible, David could be relied on in this combination. Because
definitely.
He's not a man who's content just to tell a story on, you know, one or two levels. It's got to be various things going on in there that give it a certain kind of unstable or unpredictable kind of element. And so that is how I would describe David.
Three-dimensional chess, you call it.
Three-dimensional chess.
Several times in the past couple of years. Yeah. God, it's like playing three-dimensional chess.
So you've worked a lot with David Carlo, and your contract is coming up. We'll have a few words.
What is it? This is terrible. Poor Carlo.
Let's have it on film.
I knew all along you were making an anthropological study of television making.
Yes, that's right.
He's
only
one of his students to interview you, I think.
Yeah, there's another one coming to interview you again.
Oh, my goodness.
So, has David ever lost his temper seriously in your presence?
Yes,
and it was... He has.
Good question. Another killer questions are coming out.
No, he didn't.
He never has when I've... The whole of the time in Japan, everywhere, I've never seen him more than mildly ruffled.
Well, films have got the incident on a soccer platform.
Well, that's what I'm going to say.
It's true, yes, I...
Well, I mean, I've only ever worked really closely with David, really. I've not really worked on big problems with Ian or Oliver yet, so... But David's always struck me as very, very calm. And
yes, that's right.
He's kind of calmer throughout the whole thing. So.
Yes, no, yeah, don't panic.
Don't panic. Okay, Nikki, where are you? Come here.
Oh, Nikki'd be good.
She'd
spill the beans of David on Kaboom, right.
She knows the truth about the explosives.
I don't know, is this for your obituary or my obituary?
It feels a bit like an obituary.
No, but he did lose his temper once on when we were filming on the bullet train track platform. And
is this when you got arrested, Carly?
No, that was something else. Don't even go there. We got on this bullet train and it pulled into Osaka Station, and these trains are 28 carriages long, and they're virtually a mile long, and we were at the wrong end of the train. And we had all the kind of camera gear and lots of people, and we were late and it was hot, and I didn't speak Japanese, and so we had to...
You're working like that, Carl.
No, I'm working. And we had to somehow get down to the other end of the platform. So, as ever, without quite thinking about potential consequences of what might happen, we looked everywhere for a trolley and we couldn't find one, so I took this, what was meant to be used as a food preparation trolley, to try and unload the bullet train of food. Off the platform that was going, you know, and took it, wheeled it right down the other end of the platform, took all the gear off, and we loaded this trolley, and then we set off back, you know, doing it. And suddenly all these flustered Japanese station guards were wondering about how their bullet train was going to take off in 30 seconds when they hadn't got all the food off it. Wondered where their trolley had got to, and it was 28 carriages down the road. And the bullet train people, they were going to start running late, of course, and bullet trains never run late because it affects the whole Japanese economy and bridges can't open and everything. I zoomed off down there with this and not realising what was going on, in that David then became accosted by these 14 or so trained badly because he didn't speak Japanese. Things got rather heated when they wanted their trolley back, and it was 28 platforms down the other end of the station. And the guy in charge couldn't actually realise that having 40 flight cases full of
equipment... Don't stop, Julie, be on camera, yeah?
We couldn't notice that having 40 flight cases full of really heavy equipment, why you'd possibly need a trolley to help you carry it down 28 bullet trains. So David got slightly annoyed, and it just threw me a bit. So I've never seen him angry.
So four punches thrown.
Well,
I remember meeting him at the end because he was nearly arrested, wasn't he? Because he got so angry with him.
And then
We were all quiet for days. Well, I was. Don't speak.
Come on. God. What a lie.
He was saying how interesting the film was, and then he started off about how this was the only company left, Windfall was the only company left, which made this kind of interesting film. That there had once been lots of, you know, interesting independent small companies, but they'd all been whittled away and commercialised and so on, and you were the only one left. I think I mentioned this to David and he said he was a bit exaggerating. But are there many other small...
I think there are
a couple of others, but there aren't many, and that's partly to do with what the broadcasters want, really.
Hmm. I think that if they're in the car, I'll go for them.
You know, if as a production company you're offering something which they don't want, it's not much use. If on the other hand you keep on producing things which they didn't think they wanted, but actually it turned out they quite liked, then you keep going a bit longer. And I suppose that's been our trick, that people have often, our ideas have not been something that people have gone for immediately. And then when they've actually, they haven't quite understood them, I think that's fair to say, isn't it? They
haven't quite understood the ideas.
And it's only when you've actually finished them completely and then they've seen them that they've understood what you're about. So then they begin to trust you a bit. But I think a lot of companies that have tried and...
I think once upon a time, and what we always believed was that innovation was something that was key to any production company. We always thought that's what people wanted. Innovation, new ideas, sort of all the cliches, you know, pushing the envelope and all this stuff. Whereas I think it's not really what they're after.
At this present moment?
Well, I'm not even sure it's ever been like that. I mean, maybe it has been, I don't know. But, I mean, they can afford to take a chance, maybe one, in a series of 10 programs, they'll take a chance on one. And if it fails, then that's fine, and they'll allow one to fail. So in some ways, the position you've got to get yourself into is be the company that is the one chosen to take that chance. But it's never been something that's, I mean, it might get, the program might get good reviews or something, but that's become less and less important. As audience figures have become more important. Yeah, even on Channel 4, you wouldn't expect that audience figures would be that critical, but it really is. And so we're...
And if it's bad here, it's 3 times as bad as America. We've historically relied a lot on American co-production money.
Everything just becomes so sort of bland and dull.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if one thinks of the 60s and television, I mean, it was, you know, really exciting. I mean, you know, drama was drama. Yeah. I mean, really think of the Wednesday play and fantastic. Yeah.
No.
And, I mean, it's gone, it's... There's very rarely, you know, anything that really excites one or makes one...
Why do you think that is? What is that just...
Do you think it's true, really, though? I'm not sure it's true, you say,
I think it was the odd thing out there.
Yeah.
But in terms of, I suppose what has happened is that it's become so huge and so many different, it's become so diffused.
Well, where, for example, has drama gone? I mean, what happens, of course, is if they do, I mean, what they do is do, you know, sort of trial programme.
Yeah.
And then, if they think that it's going to have even the vaguest, you know, sort of hint of being something worthwhile, they milk it and milk it and milk it. They just take that one idea and build, you know, sort of a whole series on that one idea.
Yeah.
Drama isn't like that.
Yeah.
And it shouldn't be like that. It should be, you know, sort of something that you watch from beginning to end without anything in between, you know, that has a real, you know, sort of effect. Television has just become more and more passive. I mean, you know,
it is a passive medium anyway.
But it used not to be. I mean, you know, if you watched a Dennis Potter play, for example.
In the sense that people talked about it.
People talked about it, and you felt something. I mean, you know, it sort of got at you.
But those are two separate things. I mean, it's passive in the sense that, you know, you're not interacting like
that. That's what you mean, yes.
But I mean, but the other way in
emotionally,
which...
Emotionally.
Yeah, but, but there's another way in which it has changed, I mean, I think. It's when we started on the BBC, I suppose, we could... And this happened to me a couple of times. You could be on the tube or on the bus,
yeah,
and actually hear someone talking about your programme.
There's only three channels. Three channels, you know.
Yes.
Now there's 33, and sometimes there's no. So there's not.
I remember a time when there was only one.
But the point is that though.
Yeah.
Once upon a time, when there was an event, when there was something like a big play, everybody watched
that's
it.
That's right.
And if you didn't watch that play, then you'd be watching Crossroads or something. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
There wasn't a choice. But now there's so much choice that whatever you're interested in.
Well, there isn't. I don't know that there is.
Well, that's exactly the point.
Choice. I mean, there
that's
really
exactly
is,
the
is,
point.
Is very little to watch at all.
No, I mean, I think when we went to America in 86 and we actually lived there for about a year, I was astonished. Here we were in this so-called 45 channel environment.
And there's nothing to watch. I remember
and we never
exactly
watched television. Yeah. We just completely stopped. It was like, oh, well, let's stop reading. It was equivalent.
Yes.
I used to watch a lot of television and I didn't watch anything in America.
Yes,
we completely
except
stopped
for
it.
Last Few Cities, which is British. It's important.
Occasionally, yes. Yes.
But the other thing you're missing out is video. And I'm sure that's partly why the innovation in drama is back in the theatre.
Well, it's in films, though.
It's in film, movie films.
Yeah. I mean, young people now don't think about getting into TV and making drama, they think about making feature films.
Yeah.
Which I think is a really positive thing, and it's not been like that probably ever in Britain. I mean, since the 50s, maybe. Yeah. You know, I think there's a lot of good things about this sort of the fact that TV doesn't reach the big mass audience that it used to reach. It doesn't have the impact anymore. I think that's the point. I think you're dead right. Once upon a time, you would actually hear people talking about programs you've made. And that sucks your
kick. What is so unutterably depressing is to hear, you know, what's his name, Greg Dyke, wittering on about, sort of losing,
Match of the Day.
Yeah. Absolutely, unutterably useless.
It's all I watch on TV, though.
Sorry, but you won't be able to watch it. But the next day to find that he spent $70 million on, sort of a comparable football programme.
Yeah.
I mean, it's...
Coming back to your